Hey folks, Greg Everett here. We are Rob Wolfless today. This particular podcast has been cursed from the start. This is our third time through, and we're just going to make a run for it. It's just going to be Coach Ken and me. So Rob will join us again next week, and hopefully he's not hacking up a lung, and the tuberculosis he apparently got today is gone by then. So real quickly, go check out our sponsors. We got evolvefoods.com. Get some good kind of paleo-friendly snacks there, some grass-fed whey protein and what have you. Front Desk HQ, if you run a gym, if you run any kind of service business, this is going to be the software you want to use. A lot of you are very unhappy with the software that shall remain unnamed, but you all know what I'm talking about. So this is going to be a great replacement for that. I've seen the beta version. I've seen it working. It's awesome. We're going to be getting it here at Catalyst Athletics as soon as it's ready to go. So go check out frontdeskhq.com, get the info there, and get on the list to get started with that. And then, of course, Performance Menu. Rob gave you the performancemenu.com address last time, which right at this very moment is not working because that site is being worked on for our big 100th issue launch. So go to catalystathletics.com/PM for now. All right. So with me today, we have Coach Joe Ken. Those of you who've been following us for a while have seen me post links to his stuff from time to time. You probably know he's written a couple articles for the Performance Menu. And of course, we sell his book, A Coach's Strength Training Playbook. And awesome book. Those of you who are super familiar with Michael Rutherford's Max Effort Black Box Template, you'll remember that he credits Coach Ken with a lot of the ideas that kind of sparked the ME Black Box sort of thing. So we're going to talk about that whole tier system and that book in a minute. But first of all, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Greg. Thank you very much for having me today. I know it's been cursed, but it's sometimes better late than never.
There you go. Exactly. Well, the first time was entirely my fault. I had a little time zone snafu. And the second time was my fault. I had the worst food poisoning I've ever had in my life. And so, like I said, with or without Rob, we're just going through with this. It's going to be great. So why don't you start off by kind of telling people who may not know who you are yet, kind of your background as both an athlete and as a strength coach.
Well, obviously, my name is Joe Ken. I'm 46 years old now, and my first started out, my competitive athletic career was based off of a college football career at Wake Forest. I got to play 2 years there as a starter. My first 3 years, I was injured, and that's kind of where my true passion of wanting to be a strength and conditioning coach took off. That age bracket in that early to mid-80s was really when you started to see people being hired to be just a strength or a strength and conditioning coach at a larger scale. Obviously, you know, with the college ranks, Boyd Epley was one of the first, Dan Riley, and then when Coach Riley went to the NFL, his high-intensity training and his work with Arthur Jones, it truly exploded. That was kind of my first strength coach's philosophy, a lot of the Nautilus principles, tempo. You know, now they call it tempo, and I love how, you know, Charles Poliquin has broken down the tempo, and everybody loves Charles's tempo stuff, but 20 years ago, the meathead weightlifting guys would get crazy when you would talk about four-count eccentric and two-count concentric, which was Ellington Darting and Dan Riley and Arthur Jones from Nautilus. It's just funny how you change a couple of terminologies and you lift barbell weights versus machine, and all of a sudden it's got more credibility, but that's kind of the way it is. The best part of when I grew up in Inwood, New York, I played at Lawrence High School, the same high school that my dad played with and played with my high school coach. And at my high school, if you did not lift weights, you did not play varsity. At that point in time, high school was 10th, 11th, and 12th. So going into your 10th grade year at my high school was a big deal to try to be on the varsity. Not very many 10th graders made it. I was fortunate enough to not only make it, but start. And that kind of took off the whole lifting part of it. I always tell people now at this point in my career, when I look back at my college football career, as much as I love football and that's kind of my game now at this point in my coaching career, I preferred lifting. At that point in time, the in-season training was very, really non-existent still. You know, you did all that work in the off-season, and during the in-season, it was like fade to black. And then the next January, you pretty much were just ramping up, starting back where you started. And so the game, it was an interesting mix. I trained extremely hard during the in-season because I felt like, well, this is what got me there.
Yeah.
I was a very average athletically type kid. I mean, I'm an offensive lineman. At that point in time, I thought being the biggest, strongest guy was going to be to my advantage. And at that time in football, you know, defenses, the defensive line still were two gapping, which means they had to cover two gaps. And then Jimmy Johnson revolutionized moving guys up the line, so to speak, where he's taking linebackers, making them D linemen, you know, taking D linemen, making them O linemen, taking safeties, making them linebackers, and then blitzing and shooting gaps. And it took away from the white knuckle type of offensive line play where you could just tee off, and really strength mattered. At this point in time, athleticism matters because of the way the defensive line and the talent and the athleticism of these giants and offensive linemen now, his first step a huge amount of time is laterally and not forward. Right. So now the game has changed. And for me, I always tell people, I'm glad I don't have to play at this era because I don't know where my football career would have ended.
So good at running in straight lines.
Yeah, and I mean, back then, that's what you did. You had a guy over you, and it was, okay, let's tee off, and best guy wins. And a lot of times, you know, strength was a huge proponent. It's still important, but the athleticism and the ability to move, the higher level you continue to go, the more important the ability to move comes into play. So I always felt like I was a lifter first. They don't give lifting scholarships. So unfortunately enough, I was a good enough football player to earn a scholarship and be able to study at a high, prestigious academic university like Wake Forest. I got a degree. My bachelor's degree is in health and sports science, which if you talk to a lot of people that go through Wake, one of the tougher majors as an undergraduate. And then right after that, because of injuries, I knew my football playing career was over. And so I got into coaching. And I coached 2 years at a high school in Fort Lauderdale. And then I started my college career. I had a 9-year run at Boise State, the last five as the head strength and conditioning coach for all sports. Went to Utah for about 2 football seasons. I was director of strength and conditioning for all sports. Went to Arizona State, had a great 7-year run. My first 2 years there, I was brought in as the head strength coach for football. And then after that, I took over the whole department as the head strength and conditioning coach, or head sports performance coach, excuse me, for all sports. Spent 2 years at University of Louisville, a director of athlete development for football. Then I took 1 year and opened up my own business with my wife, Big House Power Competitive Athletic Training, where I trained athletes out of my good friend and 17-year NFL vet Ricky Prohl's place out in Greensboro, Prolific Park, a high-level sports facility. If you go online to prolificpark.com, you'll see what I mean. It's a 60,000-square-foot facility, and it's got 6 athletic fields behind it. So I was real fortunate that Ricky gave me the ability to continue to coach and learn, and now I'm going into my third season as a professional strength and conditioning coach with an NFL organization.
So you've pretty much run the gamut. I mean, you've got high school, college, pro, and it sounds like you've had just about every experience you could possibly have as a strength coach. So I want to come back to that because we get a lot of questions about, you know, breaking into the industry and that sort of thing. But before we do that, and you almost touched on this a little bit, but who have been the big influences for you as a strength coach, and you know, who do you go to now, for info when you're looking for something new?
The biggest influences right off the bat was Mike Gentry, who's now at Virginia Tech and who's a legend, been there since 1987, a guy that I desperately wanted to work for early on in my career. Never really worked out. We crossed paths because we had coaches that we had known. I applied several times. It just didn't work out. But he was one of the first programs I ever saw when he was at East Carolina. We had a kid that was offered a scholarship in my high school. So that was the very first college weightlifting or strength and conditioning program I had ever seen. So, of course, back in those days, you get a copy of that. That's what you're doing. So right off the bat, Mike Gentry was the first real name I had heard as a strength and conditioning coach at college. And then as I was playing, John Gamble at the time was at the University of Virginia. They had monsters. I mean, it was impressive. And Coach Gamble was still competing, so we'd be in the middle of a game, and I'd be in a huddle, and I wouldn't even hear the play call because I'm looking on the sideline looking how big this guy is. And like, man. So those two guys, plus my college strength coach, Joey Bullock, I learned a tremendous amount from him, and not just in the X's and O's, but just in coaching in general, and, you know, learning from things that he did versus, or things that I think that may have helped us as I've gotten older, look back and said, oh, if Joey would have done this, so I better make sure I do this, especially when it comes to justifying your program. I think a lot of times, especially in this day and age, everybody's reading, and I don't really care to hear you give me a reference list of books you've read. I want your opinion. I think too many times guys, well, I read this article or, you know, Greg Everett says you should Olympic lift like this, and Louis Simmons says you should squat like this, and, you know, and Mike Bergner says you should compete like this. Well, what do you think? I mean, I know what those guys think, because guess what? I study them too. that's where the creativity, the artistic freedom that sometimes is allowed in strength conditioning for athletes may not be necessarily allowed in some of the specific training results for an Olympic lifter or a power lifter or a bodybuilder. There's unique things about that, because at the end of the day, especially in the Olympic lifts and the power lifts, you know, when you go to compete, you compete in the lifts that you train. When you train an athlete, none of the lifts you train you compete in. And so there's no protocols. I took a beating when I first developed this system of training, the tier system, because it was always, well, you got to train fast exercises first, and then you train your strength exercises, and then you train your assistant exercises. Well, and you go, why is that? Well, that's because that's what the protocols are. Well, what protocol? The protocol of lifting weights. Well, what kind of weights? Well, Olympic lifting. Well, I don't train Olympic lifters. And I know this. Every coach that you talk to that's with a sports team that's lifting is either the second or third component in their athletic development, so to speak, wants they need to last. Most competitive sports, except for throwers and sprinters in track and field, have to have some type of capacity component involved. And my big thing was always, especially with like Olympic lifts that were, those lifts get you explosive. Well, of course, if I do those the first exercise of the day, I'm going to be explosive. But I need to know what's going to happen and how I can maintain explosiveness at the end of a game. And the only way I can do that is implementing variations of Olympic or total body movements later on under a state of fatigue and measure that. That's the number I need to know. I don't need to know that a guy 10 minutes into his workout can hit a 90% clean. I need to know what percentage he can hit 60 minutes later. And I think that gets thrown out there. So that's, you know, and I'm jumping around a little bit, but that's how it kind of it evolves, is where are you going? Just because the book says that, the body will adapt. And everybody talks about, you know, block training and this training. I at the end of the day, when you train a sport, it's some type of concurrent sequence because of that practice. And very few coaches, as much as they say they want to listen, sport coaches, they'll always go back to, and that's one thing I'll say about certain coaches out there now saying some different things about why do we have to do it just because it's said it's always been done that way. And that was my thinking in 1992. So it's an interesting component of looking at different things and developing. But to go back to what your question was, those were the three main guys. And then as I've gone through the profession, what I've learned is, and one of my go-to guys is Brandon Marcello at Stanford. we were talking one day, and you know, I've heard this, and I took it to heart a little bit early on in my career, and I don't know the exact percentages, but that one saying of the 80%, 20% rule is you should spend 80% of the time on the things you need to improve on and 20% on the things that you're good on. Well, I think the exact opposite. I know what my alleged reputation is in this field. Well, I want to be great at that. I want that to be where my greatness lies. So I'm going to spend 80% on programming for strength because I know that's going to affect the other things that is part of my job, but also know that that's what I'm good at. So at that other 20%, if I have a huge staff, I'll hire that 20%. I'll hire a nutrition guy. I'll hire a movement guy. Do I know that stuff? Yes. As a strength and conditioning professional, everybody has to have a minimal knowledge base or even a little bit higher. And I know some of that stuff better than others. I think I do a very good job in the conditioning aspect of training athletes. But I'm not a track coach. I'm not a linear speed guy. I need to draw experience from those people. I was extremely fortunate at Boise State. I had Ed Jacoby, who was a world-renowned jump coach, and he really gave me the confidence that I knew I was on my way of being a good strength and conditioning coach. And then when I went to Arizona State, I had Greg Kraft, who has won multiple team national titles there, that supported our system of strength training and was very open with us, letting us know things that we can do to help improve our linear speed program. And it was funny because the number one thing he said was, you need to get your guys stronger. Yeah. So I laughed. I said, well, that's good because that's what I'm good at. So I think, you know, my go-to guys, you know, yourself in particular nowadays, in my as I evolve into more really enhancing myself as in the Olympic lifts, I've competed in powerlifting since 1989. I did a couple of small meets, deadlift meets last year. I don't know if I'll hit one this year, but so I've competed in powerlifting, and I've done a strongman meet. But you know, I'm not a professional powerlifter, so it was funny. Several years ago, my go-to strength guys at that time was in guys who've supported me wholeheartedly since about 2001 to now is Dave Tate and Jim Wendler of Elite Fitness Systems. And I found it kind of funny how when we were coming up the ranks as strength coaches, and I say strength coaches because there's so many different names we make up. Hell, I've made up some. It's just easy to say strength coach. I mean, it's just easy that way. So I went to one of their early seminars they were doing, the West Side seminars that they were doing back in the day, and now Dave's really exploited his on-site, I think he calls them underground strength series or something to that effect, where he brings in people and then all his sponsored athletes go in there for 2 days of training. But I went through their their West Side deal, and the second day was a technique day. And there were some coaches there. Well, I don't know how many of the coaches go under the bar, but I got under the bar because I needed Dave and Jim to teach me, you know, correct techniques of the power lifts. I laughed because I wrote them a letter afterwards stating, it's kind of funny to me that people think the Olympic lifts are so much more technical than the traditional strength lifts of bench, squat, and deadlift. But I can tell you this, a very good powerlifting coach can make you feel, you know, pretty dumb when you break down those lifts, just as much as a great Olympic lifting coach can make you feel pretty dumb, so to speak, when they're breaking down the Olympic lifts. And I always found it funny that, you know, and again, a lot of it's because of federation and affiliation, but, you know, a big deal to me, and I really believe this to this day, was strength and conditioning coaches, before they take a CSCS or a CSCCA, should sit for the level one club coach course that USA Weightlifting offers. I think they still offer it, because yeah, you're gonna learn the fundamental techniques of the Olympic lifts. How you use the Olympic lifts after that is your choice, but at least you're getting the fundamental basis of the Olympic lifts from the Olympic lifting perspective. And I laugh because we don't do enough of that on the other lifts. And after going through that with Dave and Jim, I just felt like people don't understand that there's a tremendous amount of technique that goes on. And you have to understand that technique to help prepare your athletes so they can feel what you know is going to happen. And the only way you can do that as a great coach, or if your ultimate goal is to be a great coach, and the only people that need to know you're a great coach is your athletes. Perception is reality. I know that. The problem with strength and conditioning coaches are, good, bad, or ugly, everything is perceived off of record.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, it's a lot of that Jimmy's and Joe's versus X's and O's, and your best strength and conditioning coaches at the college level may be your team's recruiting coordinator.
Yeah.
You know, so you got to have great people. So I think that, going back to that, you have to train. And I'm not necessarily, I know some guys will say, and I believe this if I'm coaching powerlifters, and I learned this from Dave, and he's absolutely right. I'm a class 2 powerlifter. I can do a very good job with a beginner in the sport of powerlifting. But there's going to be a point where, because of where my strength levels and my ability to strain allowed me to get to a certain point, when those athletes start to pass those of my abilities, I have to get them a coach that knows what it's like to squat 800 pounds. I've got to get them a coach that knows, you know, how to squat 1,000 pounds. Fortunately for me, training athletes, if you're doing the whole gauntlet of what we have to do to prepare an athlete for a specific sport, and a lot of that is general physical preparation, they're not spending the bulk of their time on strength, just like in the Olympic lifts. I need to know how to perform the Olympic lifts with quality exercise technique, but I have to have a terminology that's more conducive to the non-Olympic lifting athlete, because their attention span is not on lifting like a lifting athlete is. They don't care about double scoops, knee rebend. They want to know in the simplest forms, coach, how can I get my cleanup without having to worry about so many things?
Well, I think that's a good point, though, because I think a lot of strength coaches make the mistake of believing, hey, I don't coach lifting, powerlifting, Olympic lifting, whatever it is. I train people to be better football players or better sprinters, whatever. So I don't really need to know this stuff. I just need to know the basics. But I would argue that your athletes are the one who need to know the basics, like you said. But you as a coach need to know as much as possible, because the more you know, the better you are at making it simple. And I think you get the people who are kind of in that intermediate area as coaches in terms of their knowledge about something specific like Olympic lifting, and that's the worst possible place you can be. If you don't know a lot, you're probably okay. If you know a ton, you're okay. If you kind of are in that middle range, then you don't really know enough to be able to simplify adequately to an athlete who's not a lifter, because you're so overwhelmed and kind of excited about all the details that you're trying to impart all that knowledge to your athletes who don't care. They don't want to know it. They don't have time to know it, like you said. So I think the more these coaches can learn about the powerlift technique, the Olympic lift technique, the better they're going to be at saying, okay, how can I prioritize? How can I simplify this, you know, like you've done a good job of, and get these guys to do exactly what they need to do and no more. So we don't have to spend 8 weeks learning how to power clean. You know, we can build this into a long-term progression, get them to a point where they're either doing power cleans or they're doing some kind of, you know, explosive lift variation that's more appropriate for them at any given time. So we had a conversation about this several weeks ago. We were both out at Wake Forest for Coach Reeves' seminar. And so why don't you talk a bit about that? And because you are a strength coach who is definitely, a proponent of the Olympic lifts in some form, but you also are one who recognizes the fact that not every athlete can and should be using the lifts, certainly not all of them all the time. And so, you know, kind of tell people how you make that decision. How do you say, okay, I've got such and such athlete or whatever team, And rather than doing full power cleans or whatever, you know, you might normally do, how do you make that decision to say, okay, no, we're going to do, you know, power pulls instead, or we're going to do some kind of jump variation instead, you know, to kind of talk about that process a little bit.
Well, that process really for me evolved over a 25-year career, and it's still evolving till this day. As any young strength coach, when you get in, it was, you know, clean, squat, bench, snatch, incline, and we jerked. Over time, what you learn is time is a factor. The ability to accomplish mastery is based off the time that you are allowed to work with your athletes. And the more and more I get into this field, the less and less time we've had. So it becomes now, where's your bang for your buck? Where are your abilities more driven to? And I'm a huge variety guy. I believe that. But without mastery and without precision, and without efficiency, you're increasing the risk of injury. You're ramping up in a facility, or excuse me, in a part of training that really that can't happen. The number one thing that we're trying to do when we're building an athlete's body armor is obviously to put them in a sense that their confidence is high, that they've trained correctly, and we are putting them in a with movement choices and exercise progressions to protect their bodies from the chance of injury. The problem is, as we've seen, our bodies really weren't built for competitive sports, especially violent, high contact sports, especially in certain joints more so than others. So we have to do a good job of developing plans that put our people in high reward, less risk type category. Now, getting back to that, anybody who wakes up puts themselves at risk every day. You know, I think that we would be, you'd almost be saying from a non-educated standpoint that, well, we're going to do this because it's safe. Really, you put an external object in your hands, you're not safe. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's a hammer roll, a dumbbell snatch, a box jump with a weight vest. You're putting yourself at risk with external load. Hell, you're putting yourself at risk with kids that their internal loaded strength or their gymnastic strength is so poor, they may not even be able to get themselves up on a push-up right without straining a shoulder. So very, very few things have come more into fruition for us as the Block Zero program came into effect. And again, that's about building a sense of accomplishment and confidence in your abilities that you can go to a coach and tell them, hey, we're slowing this process down. We have our athletes for 4 to 5 years at college. You're going to have some of your kids at the high school level from middle school, which would be 6th grade through 12th grade. You don't just have to throw them to the wolves. If they're good enough athletically, or in some cases great athletically, anything you do, and this is a general observation, is probably going to enhance their abilities. So why not let's do it right the first time instead of having to worry about, well, we got to get a number on them. And I talked about this at Wake. I remember we used to get guys in as freshmen in football. First thing we're doing is testing them. Why? And we're supposed to be protecting them, and we're throwing them at the highest risk that we can in a weight room is a testing situation. That makes no sense. And I'm not saying that we should all be chastised. That's what we did. Yeah. And that's just the way it was. Who knew any better? Now we all know better. A lot of guys don't even test. They test within their workouts, which is what I do. And did that the last 6 or 7 years of my college career. It was, well, we don't have enough time to spend a week testing because we don't have enough time to train them. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you're starting to touch on it, but I want to make sure you really flesh it out because this is one of the favorite things that I've heard you talk about. And you can kind of talk about the Block Zero thing in this too, but the fact that you guys have had to change that system where you can't come in and just test, because these kids are coming into these programs so physically unprepared. Like you said, they can't do a push-up properly. They can't hold a plank. They can't do a bodyweight squat. They don't have mobility. You know, you guys are seeing this explosion in, you know, like shoulder subluxations and all this sort of thing that you didn't used to see. So, you know, explain that, like what you believe is the root of that problem, and kind of what, you know, how you've had to kind of change your approach, or these other high school and college strength coaches have had to change their approach to address that.
The biggest thing is the lack of free play at the adolescent level. If you are in my age bracket or even the mid-30s, you could go out any day of the week and see kids playing, whether it was in the street, in a park. It just never mattered. I mean, you were out of the house. I mean, I was out of the house. I came home from school. I put my whatever I did, my books, whatever it was, and I was back out in the streets playing. That's not even, you hardly even see it. It's amazing to me how it's changed. The computer era has changed that. More people worrying about who they're texting, who's doing this, and the ages are incredible. You know, you got kids in sixth grade got cell phones, and yeah. So what are they doing? They're spending more time with social interaction than physical play. So what has that done? On one aspect, it's given you no sense of general physical preparation and the ability to learn how to move without someone telling you how to move. On the other end of the spectrum is those that are doing sports at an early age but have specialized so early. Who plays soccer 12 days a week and on three different clubs? Who plays youth travel baseball for four different teams during the summer? So now there's that over-specialization with no general physical preparation that's leading to the high level of adolescent orthopedic injuries that are on the rise at this point in time. So what we've had to do is total rebuild. We're the general physical preparation coaches. We're the general specific physical preparation coaches. We're backwards in our society. We specialize first and then worry about the other stuff. Well, by then, these kids have so many issues, whether it's imbalances, overcompensations, kids with, you know, having Tommy John surgery at 12 years old. That's a shame. Who's to blame? I don't know. I mean, society has made this chase for the almighty scholarship and the search for greatness to a point where we're willing to sacrifice long-term health to our kids' joints than we are to them chasing the golden dream. So you can say, well, my kid won the youth, you know, 12 and under baseball state title.
And then retired at 13.
Yeah, then the kid didn't want to play anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so I think from that standpoint, it's really come to a fruition of, and block zero came into play because of training age. You know, we always talk about, well, what's an athlete's training age? Well, to me, when you train with me for the first time, you're at training age zero. Just like if my sons are pretty decent lifters. If I brought them to a point, but if I ship them out to train with you, your program is very different than mine. Their training ages is zero with Catalyst Athletics. With me, their training age is, you know, one is at 8 and one is at 5.
Yeah.
So when I get a freshman class, do I study their abilities? Do I look at where they came from, whether it be a strong high school program or a strong private sector coach that I respect? Yes, but at the end of the day, our terminology, our teaching progressions, our ability to write a program is going to be different. So they are at a training age of zero. And I think that investment in time, or no matter when a kid comes into your program, is highly important. And everybody's Block Zero program is probably going to be similar in some movements, slightly different in organization of other, because then it becomes how much time do you have to invest. If you're doing it in a high school gym class and the typical class is 50 minutes, you probably really got 30, because you got 10 up front and 10 at the back end that these kids got to get prepared to go. So yeah, you have to factor all that into your programming design. I tell this people all the time, you can write the greatest program on paper, but until you run through it, you're going to find flaws, because it all goes back to what are you going to get accomplished, and then how much time do you have to accomplish that in? And that's where and again, that goes back to the art part of program design, not necessarily so much the science. Science is extremely important. I really believe that. And people get on me sometimes because I talk about, you know, I am the research, or, you know, my research is in my weight room. Because when I look at research, and my good buddy, one of my other go-to guys, Matt Ray, one of the best, now he's not very young, but at one point he was an up-and-comer in strength training research in the United States. And he came and saw us train, and I would tell him what we're doing. He goes, "You can't do that. You can't do that." And I said, "Well, come and watch my guys train." I said, "Because you're not just going to see my best guys do it. You're going to see my team do it." And he'd say, "Well, you're 5 years ahead of what the research says." And I go, "And that's my problem with research, is most of it is a review of literature. I want to know what's going on now. The only way I'm going to know what's going on now is to travel and talk to coaches that are doing it now. Because by the time it gets to a research journal, it's already passed by. Now, there's other things that research are important to as far as effects of metabolic demands and stuff, but I'm talking specifically about what happens in weight rooms because right. I'm a strength guy, and that's what I'm going to bare my bones on when I go down swinging is strength is a component that's needed for all the other things that we can talk about in the development of athleticism. So I got to make sure that that's on point, because that's going to help all of our stuff. And so an exercise technique is important with that. The older the athlete becomes, the more mobility is a factor, especially at the professional level, especially at a professional football level. I really, truly believe this. Like I said, I've been very fortunate and extremely humbled to work from 10-year-olds to NFL All-Pros, and I've had some of the best people work with me. Were they called assistants? Yes, and, you know, but most of these guys, these were my colleagues. These were my counterparts. I just happened to be the guy who was entitled head. But I have some of the best coaches I've ever worked with that have gone on and made tremendous strides on their own, and that was our big proponents of selling was, hey, what are we doing? Let's try to do something that's innovative. Let's take what everybody's done and kind of go outside the grid. Like everybody talks about, oh, you know, Big House, you know, my nickname, he thinks outside the box. Well, not in my box. This is my box. I believe this, and that's another thing that for young coaches, you have to believe in your programming. You want to sell your athletes, so to speak, or you want your athletes to really buy what you're selling or really want to listen to you, they got to see the passion, and it comes from your heart and your gut. And that's the one thing that's been exciting to me when you develop a unique system based off everything you've learned is it comes from a passion and inside. That's why a lot of times I don't disregard this, because I started this way when I started presenting. That's why a lot of times I don't need to bring a PowerPoint presentation when I speak. I've developed a system that is so ingrained in my body, I can just go on for hours. And right. I think more coaches need to be able to do that. Are there certain times you got to throw a chart up there when you're talking about lifting? Of course. If you're going to talk about technique protocol, yeah, I get it. You want to show a slide, but you should never have to look at that slide.
Well, so let's talk about then. You talk about your system. So you have two books out currently. You've got your first one, Coach's Strength Training Playbook, and then Push, Jump, Punch, which is your kind of long-term power clean progression system. But so let's talk about Coach's Strength Training Playbook, because that's the one where you lay out what you call your tier system, which is basically a really in-depth template for programming, you know, strength and conditioning programming for just about any athlete. And I think you tend to use kind of the football example, which is the obvious one to go with, both based on your background, but also based on the fact that that's pretty much the dominant sport that strength and conditioning is going to be hooked to in this country. But so tell me about kind of how that developed over the years, and, you know, what, how did you get to that point where you said, this is a solid enough system, I'm confident enough in this, I see how it works, where you felt comfortable putting that in print and putting it out there? Because that's, I think a lot of people underestimate, the guts it takes to put that stuff on paper and put it out there for the world to see, because not everyone's going to be real happy about it. Not everyone's going to come around and tell you how great you are. There's a lot of people out there who just sit around, and Rob and I talked about this in the last podcast, who sit around and just wait for stuff like that and just snipe at you, you know, from high up in the treetops, you know, who've never done anything themselves, who've never contributed anything, but they just can't wait to get on you about every little flaw they find in your thing. So, you know, tell me about that whole process there, because that, I tell you what, I sat down and I read that book in one afternoon. It was amazing. It was awesome. I refer people to it all the time. Even when I get requests like, hey, I need you to do programming for my son, you know, high school football. It's like, I don't do that. Just buy this book. You know what I mean? And you're set. So talk about that whole development there.
Well, I'll backtrack a little bit. But so people can understand, like you said, when do you get the guts, or when do you think like, wow, do you really want to put this out there? Because like you said, it's a crazy world. But that book was published in 2002. But the actual first, what I would call tier system programming, occurred my second year as a graduate assistant in 1992. At Boise State, when I primarily started implementing it with the women's basketball, women's volleyball, and women's gymnastics teams at Boise State. And what it was is kind of like I was saying. I've been a meathead. Everyone's sport, so to speak, or everyone's programming at that time was a bastardized football program. You just got kicked down. Oh, well, what are we going to do for basketball? Well, let's do this football program, you know.
Right.
And I didn't want that. I was given control of these teams, so to speak, from a programming standpoint. So I was going to do things slightly different. This was also at a time when most programs that were free weight were four-day-a-week splits. And then the other proponent was the high intensity, which was 3 days a week. And I always felt that one of my personal commitments was to always be in great physical condition. And I loved the weight room. But what I noticed a lot of times was in my own training, it was hard to get up when you had a hard conditioning day and you had to go in the weight room or lift, or you were lifting first and you knew you had to have a hard conditioning day. So I was looking at a way where can I make this where there's a focal point each day of the week, so to speak, where I don't have to worry about effort. The last thing you want to do as a coach is coach effort. The other thing was, at that point in time, it was the two-day split, you know, upper, lower, and then you would put a hang clean or a power clean or a snatch at the beginning the day of the week that you trained. Well, and most team sports at the college and the youth settings are whole body sports. You're not going to go out and play football and they tell you first half put your arms behind your back and then the second half you can't run. So why wouldn't I want to train the athlete in a whole body scenario, so to speak. And that's really, I learned that from my background with my college strength coach and studying the high intensity training, because even though it was more broken down into body parts, so to speak, you trained the whole body in high intensity training. Now, there were a lot more isolation movements, but that component made sense to me. Well, why wouldn't I want to train the whole body every time I walk in the weight room if that's the way it's going to that's what we're asking it to do when we take it to the sport. So then I looked at it, though, I didn't want to do individual isolation stuff, so I looked at it from my standpoint of the big lifts. Well, how can I do a clean squat bench, so to speak, or pull a squat variation and a press within the same workouts without too much stress and getting quality work throughout the week? And that's where I started looking at the templated rotation of exercises. A lot of times I think when people read the book at first, they think the tier system is based off the cycling. And cycling and intensities and loads are extremely important. But the true template, the true integrity of the tier system is the structured rotation of the movement categories per day. That in itself, and that's the one thing that everybody asks me, what do you pride yourself on when the tier system is changed and how you evolve what's going on in the tier system? At the end of the day, my number one priority is keeping the integrity of the template.
Right.
That to me is the crucial way. How can I construct a better program in what I believe wholeheartedly is a terrific way to train athletes without breaking the integrity of the template? And that's how it's evolved. So going back to picking the rotation of exercises, so this is 92. We're going through, and again, I looked at it from the old heavy, moderate, light system, where, you know, one day you train heavy, one day you train light, one day you train moderate. And what happens with that is when you take a simple scenario such as, we'll just say we're going to do clean, squat, and bench, the big three, and we're going to do that 3 days a week, heavy, light, moderate. Well, as you know, when you go into a meet, it's extremely hard to train both movements heavy in the same workout.
Sure.
And again, in a meet, it's slightly different because the volume is not as high. But in training, the volume's high. It's much higher than a meet. So if I'm going to do, say, five sets of five on my heavy day at 85%, and I'm going to do what the old rule is, what now I call them total body movement, but your explosive or Olympic lifting movement first, your lower body strength movement second, and your upper body strength movement third, and all of those are going to be trained at 85%, five sets of five, I'm not making through that workout.
That's a tough day.
Yeah, you're not getting through. You're going to have a hard enough time getting through the cleans.
Well, especially when you got to go run bleachers and, you know, do drills on the field after that.
Yeah, exact. Or before.
Right.
So then you go to the light day. And this is before I learned about dynamic effort through Westside Barbell and Louis Simmons writing in Powerlifting USA and the speed of movement, rate of force development, and all those things I had learned after the fact. But then if you go to light day and say it's five sets of five at 65%, well, that day may be too easy. And then you get to your moderate day, you do five sets of five at 75%. That's probably the best workout of the week. You got quality work done. You were able to achieve every repetition that was prescribed in the prescribed amount of sets, and you got a nice, your body feels like it's got a sense of accomplishment. So I looked at it like, okay, we're always going to test the big three. So obviously, that's your foundation or your core movements. That's what we've got to build our programming around in the weight room. But you can't, if you go by the old philosophy of Olympic, lower, upper, you're never putting your chance to succeed in the lower and the upper body movement. So that's when I said, okay, if these are the three major movements that we're going to do, a total body, lower body, and upper body, one day a week, these movements have to be first.
Right.
So that became the heavy emphasis or the tier one exercise. So when you hear someone say they're doing tier system session T, or at that in that era it was session E, you knew it was the total body movement is going to lead off. If it was session L, it's the lower body. If it's session U, it's the upper body. So that was our priority tier movement, our foundation or core movement. Then tier two was the secondary or major movement of the day, and that would be based off of the original rotation. So on session T, tier two is L, and then tier three is U. But now, and then session L is LUT, and then session U is UTL. And then what we did is we looked at that heavy, moderate, light graph, and we looked at it from the standpoint of, well, if we felt the moderate day from an intensity standpoint was the best training day from the standpoint of workload and effort, how do we make each one of those days a moderate type of average? Well, very simple. Tier one is heavy, tier two is moderate, and tier three is light. And then you structure your cycling based off of that. So if we go back to what we talked about in the original example, so now tier one is 85 5x5, tier two is 75 5x5, and tier three is 65 5x5. Guess what? They're getting all the work done.
Right.
And I don't have to worry about, well, the bench was only 65 5x5, because on day three, they're going to do their 85% 5x5.
Yeah.
And they're going to be able to accomplish that because they're not under the fatigue and the duress of having to do their cleans and their squats first.
And they get to emphasize each different thing on a different day.
Right.
Instead of it always being the last thing where, like you said, you're just so burnt by that point, you're not into it. You can't do it.
And then when you talked about that, and again, the explosive exercise, and this is where, again, it took, and I'll throw back a little story as we're going through this, but then it was like, okay, now on Wednesday, your tier three exercise is a total body or an explosive lift. And this is where now, this is where, like you said, you got to have some guts to throw this out there, because in this era, you're not putting an Olympic lift after a squat and an incline. It's just not happening. And we would, and at that point, I was still doing snatches. So it was a hang snatch. But again, my theory was I have to do an explosive element with the fatigue. I got to see if these guys can maintain this ability to be explosive, or what I now call a power capacity or power endurance. And we did it this way. And then we developed this plan and this structured rotation of exercises. And we start doing it with these sports, and we're training 3 days a week, whole body, and our women are just killing it. Well, as the assistant and the graduate assistant, our head strength coach was still doing football, and they were doing a 4-day split, and you know, I was in charge of these programmings. He allowed me to free reign. I developed this system, so in some ways, I have to give Coach Thompson a lot of credit, because he empowered me with the ability to do that. When you worked for me later on, I wanted to continue to build this program, so you had to use it. If you were hired by me, you had to use my template. Now, there was a lot of creative freedom, but that template stayed in place because I wanted to see it work with other coaches implementing some of their own ideas as far as exercises and cycling.
Sure.
But so then, you know, it's kind of an easy sell because you're dealing with women athletes. They, you know, they don't really see themselves as wanting to lift 4 days a week. So it kind of worked it to my advantage. It was very quick and deliberate. Our training times had decreased, and our athletes felt better, and their athleticism improved. I mean, their jumping, their ability to change direction with our running program included, really took off. In 1994, when I took over football, I was so convinced this could work that I knew I had to stay with this plan, but I also did not have the credibility or the confidence or whatever you want to call it at that time. It was my first time as a head job of telling our coaches, hey, we're only going to train 3 days a week. So that's why I created this session A or auxiliary day. And that's where we did a lot more of the back work, your isolative shoulder work, and things like that, so that we did say we lifted 4 days a week. It was almost a, you know, a CYA day, because I wanted the football coaches to think that we were lifting 4 days a week. So we do this, and we're having success. Well, in 1996, I hire Rich Gray as my graduate assistant / assistant. That was the only help we had. Rich is now the director of athletics for Hammer Strength, and is one of my dearest friends. He's probably family. And we're doing this. He goes, you got to write an article on this. And I go, well, you got to submit an article to the, you know, the NSCA, what is this, the Strength and Conditioning Journal. That was their practical journal. Right. I'm like, Harvey Newton at the time was he the president or the editor? But I know Harvey pushed me over the top to finish the article. So make a long story short, Rich literally locks me in my office and I write the article. I send it in and I know what's going to happen. I'm dealing with the NSCA, who believes in, you know, the typical standard protocols of allegedly lifting weights. Fast exercises first and so forth. We all know it. Sure enough, I get the critiques back and you know exactly what they said. This makes no sense. You can't do that. Who says this? So now I'm pissed. I'm like, F this. I knew it. Well, Rich, and again, I owe a lot to Rich on this. He calls Harvey and explains to Harvey, and I don't know what was said. All I know is Rich came back and said, Harvey said, you gotta finish this. This has to go out. And he said, just answer their questions why you do what you do. So I'm like, do half of these guys even lift weights that are writing this? Are they even strength coaches? Who's reviewing my paper? I mean, now I'm in defense mode. Right. You know, like, at that point, I'm 20-something years old. I just want to be a good coach and whatever. You know, whatever. So long story short, well, I'm never long story short. That's just, you know. So I answer their questions. I say exactly what we've been talking about now for probably an hour, and I send it out, and sure enough, I get published in the Strength and Conditioning Journal, and that was 1997. That was it. That's when I wrote really the first of four editions of this playbook before it was published. So I go through, I write this book up. So now I wanted, because I study football coaches. And football coaches have playbooks, so I was like, well, why shouldn't I have one?
Right.
And so I wrote this book, so when people worked for me, we'd have a common denominator to talk about training. So then I go to Utah, I bring the program with me. Now I'm gaining more credibility now. And it was Kyle Whittingham, who's now the head coach at Utah, who really gave me the confidence to drop the A day, because he was a weight room guy. He was our weight room liaison, great guy, tremendous coach, and he's always in the weight room working out, so he's watching what we do. So it's my first, we finished my first winter, and the results are exceptional. Oh, I had great players. I mean, it's going to be, you know, it doesn't really matter what you do when you got really, really good players. So we hit, he comes down and we're just chatting. They were in my office and he goes, we only train 3 days a week, don't we? And I'm like, oh. I was like, no, we train four. We have 3 days in all. He goes, but really, we only train 3 days a week. I said, yeah. He goes, man, I knew you could do it that way. When he said that, the A day was gone.
Yep.
There it is, man. A coach, he gave me the confidence just like that. I mean, I can almost remember where I was sitting in that Utah strength coach, in that strength office, where he stood right at the doorway. And as soon as he said, I mean, before he could even finish the sentence, the A day was out. It continued to evolve. And then at Utah, I had very, very good coaches. One of them was Jason Veldkamp, who is now the head strength coach at NC State for football, but made a tremendous mark with Bobby Petrino at Louisville, as well as with him at Arkansas. He took over for me at Utah and was there when Urban Meyer got there and had, I think, the Liberty Bowl year. Then he left for Louisville right before they went undefeated at Utah. Mark Uyama, who just coached in the Super Bowl, was one of our he was an undergraduate assistant at the time. Cheyenne Petrie, who had played for me at Boise State, was a head strength coach at Buffalo. And then Scott Croft, who's now coaching, I believe, at a Velocity in the Midwest, was our other assistant. And then we had a student assistant. I called him Squiggy. He's still at Big John is still at Utah. He's the head strength coach for Olympic sports there. So it's kind of funny. But when we left for Arizona State, I wind up hiring Cheyenne and Mark to come with me. And that's when the tier system, so to speak, from a strength standpoint and from a overall program standpoint, as we graduated and I took over the whole program, all the sports did it. That's when it really blossomed and it was time to put it out there and just see what happened. And again, I don't expect 100% of strength and conditioning coaches to agree with it. Just like there's certain things that I don't agree with because this is, I believe in what I do. But yeah, it doesn't make it right or wrong. As we've seen, a quality program is going to enhance. As long as a program is structured, has organization, and the coach that's implementing it believes in it in his heart that this is the right way to do it, you're going to have success as long as that you keep the science and certain things in play. But if there's a non-structured program, you just go in there and you hit it hard every day, I don't think that you're getting the most bang for your buck. And then from there, I respect strength coaches who made a long-term run at one program. It's hard to see, you know, oh, I wonder what I want, you know. People say, oh, I don't look back in the past. And I don't. I believe everything that's happened in my career from a professional and a personal situation with my family and stuff has happened for a reason. It's the way it was supposed to be. I look back sometimes when I see a Coach Gentry at Virginia Tech since 1987, and some of these coaches who have had long-term runs, 10, 12, 14 years at different programs, I could still be at Boise State. I didn't necessarily have to leave. I chose to leave. I chose to, you know, take a couple of leaps of faith in this field and see what's up, because I felt deep down that I need, if this program in my mind was going to be justified as a legitimate way to train athletes, it couldn't just happen at one spot.
Right.
It had to be at different types of places with different types of kids and different types of sports. And it is an all-encompassing thing. That's why I said it's an athletic-based system of training. It's not a football-based, because you can take the same exact template and plug in very unique exercises that have a little bit more merit for other sports. Like, not every sport has to clean. Why would you clean an athlete like a tennis player or a baseball player where their hands and wrists are so important? It's not worth the risk. But a clean pull or a shrug pull or a power pull, that has some merit because of the hip extension component. So those are, so it doesn't have to be, at the end of the day, all athletes for the most part need to do some type of, you know, hip extension squatting movement, whether it's a single leg or a double leg, a pressing movement and a pulling movement. Whatever those are, that's your choices, but they fit into our template.
Well, I think that's why it's such an effective template, because it's not a fixed program. You know what I mean? It's a really clear set of guidelines to allow a coach to adapt that system to exactly the needs of his program and his athletes in, you know, whatever sport. So I think that's where the power of it comes in. We're pretty much running out of time here, but I do want to finish by getting some just getting some thoughts from you. I can't tell you how many emails we get in a week of people asking, you know, basically, how do I get into the strength and conditioning industry? You know, what do you recommend I do? What kind of certifications, blah, blah, blah. And of course, I'm not a professional strength and conditioning coach. I run a private facility. I coach competitive weightlifters. So I'm the last person to give advice. My advice is always pretty much go work with the coaches, the kind of coaches you want to be like. Go intern with them. Go get a mentor. That's what you need. But, you know, can you fairly briefly kind of give these guys who are maybe just starting out in college or coming out of college, kind of give them a push in the right direction? You know, what would you suggest are, you know, a couple big things they need to do to try to kind of break into that industry, either collegiate or professional strength coaching?
Well, the collegiate, I think, is a little bit easier because in the end, we've all done it. You can apply and hopefully you have some type of contact and you can start off with these unpaid internships. It's kind of a tough deal, but it's kind of the way of life in being a coach. You're going to work for free at some point if you really want it. It's a very tough grind. That's a lot of good coaches that don't last because it's a fight. I mean, it's a fight every day to make it to the next level you want to be. And volunteering is the easiest way. I would really say if you know this is something you want to do in college and you're a college undergrad, you've got to get in there and hopefully that head strength conditioning coach at that university will sit with you and get a liking to you where they'll allow you to do some internships while you're still an undergrad and you can gain some credit because now you're in their system. Now it's easier for them to recommend you for a graduate assistant position job. And then from there, you successfully do a graduate assistant. Now it's easier for that coach to help you get an entry-level coaching job. And it's a climb the ladder. And it truly is. You have to build a network. I know people like, oh, that's bull crap. I'll make it on my own. No one makes it on their own. No one. We would need another hour for me to thank every one of the coaches that worked with me, who I've had the ability to work with from a sport coach standpoint. It's just a matter of who's going to give you your break. It's like I say, and I forgot who I heard this from. If someone works for me or comes to work with me, I know what I can do for you, but what are you going to do for yourself? That is the problem. These people want you to get them in the door, and then they want you to keep moving them on. What are you going to do for yourself? What is going to separate you from all the other interns that I'm going to be like, that's the one. That's the next superstar. What niche are you going to take? Hey, everybody's going to lift weights. At this day and age, it's the perfect time for young strength coaches to find that niche with all the, you know, buzzes of corrective measures, the nutrition aspect, recovery, all the little nuances that I say are my 20%, be that person. I'd probably hire you.
Right.
You know, be those guys. I mean, when I worked at the University of Louisville, I had two of the best, for the lack of a better term, niche guys. Brian Dermody was the best, and I don't even have to work with everybody in the nation, was the best strength and conditioning coach when it came down to practicality and the evaluation of screening and the correct, what people call now corrective measures programming. I believe that in my heart till this day. Brian's out of coaching now and he's doing ministry work, but I don't care. That guy was the best. What he did and his passion to that, I couldn't, it's second to none. And then from a practical nutrition standpoint, Adam Feit, who worked with me at three different places, he was the best at putting a nutrition plan that was idiot-proof for athletes. He dumbed it down where it made sense. And that's what it has to do. It has to make sense. So you have to be that. That, to me, is the number one thing I think young strength coaches should do. We know you're going to know strength. We know you're going to do your linear speed and your metabolic and energy system stuff. But But what unique thing are you going to bring that's going to set yourself above someone else when all these resumes come into play? Be that guy. Be that woman.
There's perfect.
There's just tremendous amount of opportunities out there because guys like me are going to stick to what got them there. They're right. Expecting the new revolution to bring the new and innovative ideas. And in any job fashion, you got a CEO who's 20 years and he's confident that he's going to be the CEO. He's going to bring in people that bring new and invigorating ideas to his company. It's just like, I know this. We just hired a new assistant and he'll start Monday. I got to raise my game.
Yeah.
It's go time for me now because I got to show, hey, this dude's coming to work for me. I got to show him why I am who I am, more so than he needs to show me.
Yeah.
You know, so like I said, that to me would be the best of the best, Greg. And I mean, I know we're going crazy. Maybe next time Rob won't be sick and we can do a part two or something.
We definitely need to do a part two and possibly a part three because I think, I think we could go on and on about all this stuff. I still had like 40 more questions for you. So we'll definitely come back, do another one. And just to wrap it up, why don't you tell people where they can get more info, where they can pick up your book, and you're working on now a new edition of the Strength Training Playbook, right?
Yeah, I'll start with that. Right now, after too many BSing around, I've actually started to get all my notes together and rebuild the coach's Strength Training Playbook. It's not going to be a second edition because really, except for the periodization chapter, it's almost a total rewrite. And I'll be adding several chapters. I'm going to add a chapter on Prilipin's chart and the rules that we've developed, as well as my version of density training, which I call volume accumulation training. Those are the two major cycles that I use within the tier. And some of the advancements that we've kept the integrity but made some unique changes in things that help expedite the programming. The coach's strength training playbook can be purchased off my website. That's run by my wife and my son, www.bighousepower.com. It's off your website, Catalyst Athletics. And Dave Tate, who's been a tremendous supporter of me personally and professionally, carries my products on elitefitness.com. And then I think both books are on Amazon. And then my website does have some free information. It is a subscriber base. I apologize to my subscribers that we have not done a very good job since I took this professional coaching job of keeping it up to date. We have a lot of film. We're trying to get a staff together to help edit and get some of that stuff up for the professional site as well as the free site. So those are the things we're working on. And I truly am. If there's one thing I wish I could do more of is apologize to the people that go to the site and have invested in the membership, and we have to do a better job of updating that for them.
Cool. Well, you got to keep your athletes playing well first.
So. Yeah, there's no question about that, and I hope people understand that.
Yeah, they do. They love you. All right, buddy. Well, thank you very much for finally making it on. And the next time we come back and do this, I'm sure we'll get it done the first time instead of the third.
I got you, my man. Well, I appreciate it. And again, I appreciate any time we get to talk strength training. I can do it all day. I think my wife already left. I got to go help her walk the dogs.
There you go. All right, man. Have a good weekend.
You too, we'll talk to you soon. We'll see you. Thanks.
Okay, see ya.
Bye.